Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, author Sash Bischoff discusses her hit debut novel, Sweet Fury, a twisty, thought-provoking novel, in conversation with the works of F. Scott Fitzgerald. Bischoff is interviewed by author Kathleen Rooney. This conversation originally took place February 12, 2025, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Thank you so much, everybody, for being here. This is an incredible turnout. I'm so honored, so excited to discover this incredible museum. I wish that I had spent the entire day here. And thank you so much for doing this with me.
My pleasure. I am the interviewer. So I'm also a college professor at DePaul, and I always like to give a roadmap for, you know, what we're going to be doing. And so we're going to start with a little bit about the book from the author herself, and then a little reading of an excerpt to give you a taste of it. And then we're going to do roughly 30 minutes of conversation between ourselves. And then that's when you come in, and we're going to do audience Q&A for 10 or 15 minutes at the end. So as we go, think of your questions, because I bet that you'll have answers. So take it away.
I hope I'll have answers. Yes, so for those of you who have not yet read the book, Sweet Fury is a literary thriller, and it's about a famous film actress whose name is Lila Crane. She's America's sweetheart. She's adored throughout the whole world. And at the start of the book, she and her famous film director boyfriend, Kurt Royal, move from LA to the West Village in New York City because they are preparing to make a feminist adaptation of Fitzgerald's final completed novel, Tender is the Night, which they're shooting in the Hamptons. And so she's playing the leading role, Nicole Diver, in the film. And so to prepare for the role, she begins working with a therapist in the West Village to dig into her own trauma of her own past to prepare. And as she is on the therapy couch, her life begins to unravel, and the characters in the book soon become entangled in a deadly game of revenge. So here's a little excerpt. I'm just going to read the prologue because it's super short, and if I read anything after that, I start to give up spoilers. She stands there in the aftermath, trapped behind a wall of glass in a silent, seismic horror. Outside, dawn is just beginning its pearl, the sky over the Hudson a blooming bruise, skin of the water slate to silver, fingers of fog curling in. The world a milky calm, still unmarred by the carnage within. But she knows nothing will ever be the same again. Her stunned gaze travels down to her dress, stippled darkly with red, her innocent hands somehow sticky with blood. So much blood everywhere, so terribly bright. Her stomach swells. She can't think of it. She takes in the surviving remnants of the devastated room, the black book, the apocalyptic painting, the gold mask with its unseeing eyes, the knife. Beyond the glass, the clouds shift, and the blade flashes, blinding. She won't look at the slump of flesh on the floor, puddles still spreading, the sick within her rising. No, she must put a stop to it, once and for all. He's turned towards the balcony, backlit against the horizon's slow swell, one foot lunging before the other in a runner's stance, as though it might be any other morning, as though he might simply go for a jog, return with a coffee steaming in the early chill. In the distance, one by one, the green lights of the shore beyond begin to blink out. She must act quickly. Time is running out, and she's still in mortal danger. She presses her palms to her ears, forces her focus to the sound of that soothing inner swirl, draws within herself a plucked chord singing to stillness, breathes. She opens her eyes, unlocks her phone, and then she places the call. "Please help me," she whispers, and the tears begin to stream. "Someone's been stabbed. Oh God, I think he's dead."
All right, I have a bunch of questions, but I'm going to start with I love getting to do these because my favorite question is sort of where an author's spark to embark on the whole project comes from. And so my question is kind of, which came first in your book? Because it's so steeped in, it's F. Scott Fitzgerald, but it's also a thriller. And so I'm curious, like, did you start from the idea, I want to write a thriller, and then Fitzgerald came later? Or did you start with, like, I'm obsessed with Fitzgerald, and I want to write something about him, and then you were like, oh my gosh, a thriller? Or was it neither of those
things? Yeah, it's an interesting story. So as my aunt mentioned, I started as an actor and then had a career for 11 years as a professional theater director on Broadway and off. I was the associate director in 2020 of Dear Evan Hansen on Broadway and the national tour, which basically meant that I was running and overseeing these shows. So that was my full-time job. And then on March 12th or whatever day it was, I was in the rehearsal room putting in an actor for the show that night. And we got the call that the industry was shutting down. And so just like that, my industry went away. Up until that point, I had written my whole life, but it always had come secondary to theater. I'd written two novels. One was horrible, which nobody will ever read, and the second one was okay, but it was not published. And so at this point, I had amassed some connections in the publishing world, but didn't have a publishing deal yet. And so I had no industry. It was in the pandemic. I had nothing to do but sit and mope and walk my dogs with a mask on. And so I went to an agent that I developed a relationship with, and I pitched her five ideas for five different books. And one of those, the last one that I pitched her, she said, that's the book that you need to write. That's the book that I've never read before. And to answer your question, I kind of bullshitted, right? Like, it was just like a paragraph of an idea. I didn't really know what the book was about, but I had two ideas. I knew that I wanted to document the relationship between an actress and her therapist through their therapy session notes together. And then I had the idea for the book's big final twist. So I had the beginning and the ending, but I didn't know how to get from A to Z. And so I wrote the first draft really fast in like 6 months, and I submitted it to my writers group. And at that point, I mentioned they're making a film in the book. At that point, it was a made-up film, and it was horrible. And I knew that it was a placeholder, but I didn't know how to fix it. And so I submitted this draft to my book, to my group. And one of the writers in my group, this incredible novelist, Blair Hurley, who you should all read if you have never read her before, she said, you know, the themes and the subject matter of your book are really reminding me of Tender as the Night. What if your characters were making an adaptation of Tender? And I had never read Tender as the Night. I had only ever read The Great Gatsby. And so I stopped everything and I read Tender as the Night, and I realized her suggestion was genius. And so then I went down this Fitzgerald rabbit hole where I love research. So I read literally everything that Fitzgerald ever wrote and almost every single book that was ever written about him. And the deeper that I dug, the more I realized that Sweet Fury wanted to be in conversation not just with Tender as the Night, but with his entire body of work.
That's a heck of a writing group. That's amazing.
They're amazing.
Yeah. So I want to talk more about the book specifically, but I am interested in the sort of way that you kind of started as an actor and then a director and then, became more focused on writing. So can you talk a bit about your experiences in those fields and like how, if at all, those skills are transferable? Like, do you feel like it gave you like an edge as a writer having worked in staged narrative?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it certainly helped with the subject matter of this book because this takes place in the film industry. There's a lot of like inside baseball between actors and directors and writers. But yes, basically just to give you a brief history, as I said, I began as an actor. I started acting professionally when I was six because I was one of those incurably shy children. And my mom said, this has got to change. And so she said, theater is the answer. She had me audition for a show. I got in. I did it. She said, okay, you're cured. Moving on. And I said, no, I found my passion. And so then I began acting professionally, regional theater, community theater, children's theater, and then, and this is mostly in San Diego, and then As I got into high school, I also got into film and TV as well, and I started after school some days, would drive up to LA and do film and TV, and sometimes shooting in the middle of the night, and then driving back in the middle of the night and going to school. While all of that was happening, my amazing mentor and theater teacher in high school said, you know, I think you have an eye for directing. And I began to direct a little bit in high school and found that I really liked it too, but I was still very much had my blinders on and was determined that I was going to be an actor when I grew up. When the time came to figure out what college I was going to go to, I was really torn as to whether I wanted to go the more academic route or whether I wanted to go the conservatory route. Ultimately, I chose Princeton because of its creative writing program. It's one of the best in the country. And so I went through that. As my aunt mentioned, I studied with Joyce Carlos and Jeffrey Eugenides. Joyce was my advisor for my thesis. That was the first horrible novel. And it was horrible because my other thesis that my aunt mentioned was directing both parts of Angels in America, which is an 8-hour play, and the play opened the week that the novel was due. So it was an impossible task. And then I moved on to, you know, as I mentioned, this theater directing career. But I was always, you know, I always had writing sort of in my back pocket. I wrote this second novel. I created this writer's group that we've been 16 years strong. And as of this year, all 5 of us are published novelists, which is incredible. And they've been my backbone, and this book would not exist without them. But, to answer your question, I think, you know, one of the reasons that I decided to make that shift from acting to directing was that I enjoyed directing. Directing's a much broader scope. I think the way I sort of see it is that as an actor, you are one very important piece of a puzzle, and as a director, your job is to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. So I really love that challenge. I loved working intimately with the actors. I loved sort of creating the broader vision of the show. I loved working with the designers and creating it visually, bringing it to life. And so these are all sort of like elements of control, and I certainly like control. So writing is just sort of like a further step of that, right? Where with writing books, you get to create the characters and the plot and the world of the book itself. But I do think, you know, directing theater, coming from that professional world, I had built in an intimate understanding of pacing and tension, and in terms of building character, of motive and action and conflict for all the characters, and theatricality and drama and stakes. And those things really helped me immensely as I taught myself really how to build a suspense novel. On a more personal note, this book, which we may get into, sort of deals with some Me Too themes. And you know, I will say that I both witnessed and was subjected to prejudice both as an actor and as a director. I mean, I think we all know that for female actors, both in TV and film and in theater, there's a huge emphasis placed on being young and beautiful and small and thin. And for me, growing up as a teenager and trying to figure out my own body and my own insecurities, constantly being judged based on my sort of my self-worth based on my appearance was an immense source of anxiety and insecurity for me. And I knew that as I got older, it was only going to get worse as a woman. And that was something that I really, you know, didn't want to deal with. And so that's one of the reasons that I left acting behind. When it came to directing, you know, I think everyone knows that the film and TV world is very much still a gentleman's club. That's very true still of the theater world as well. There are a handful of female directors who have made their way to the top, and some of them are incredible at helping other women. And there are others that do have reputations for going out of the way to do the opposite. I think because they are so few and far between. And so for me, as a director, most times I would find myself at the head table and I was the only woman. And I found that I had to get really good at shape-shifting and transforming myself based on the specific scenario that I was in order to get ahead. And this book sort of pushes that idea to the extreme and explores the dangers and the consequences of that gamesmanship.
Excellent answer. like you've already said, the characters are working on this feminist adaptation of Tender is the Night, and, you know, she's playing Nicole. And I'm curious, like, how familiar or not do you think readers need to be with that specific book or with just Fitzgerald's work in general?
My hope is that you don't have to be familiar at all. And that is the feedback that I've gotten. So I'm hoping it's true. I think my hope is that people that haven't read Fitzgerald or only read Gatsby and it was in, you know, back in high school, that they can read this and that I hold your hand enough to get you through the basics of what you need to know. And you can just appreciate it on the thriller level. But definitely for people that do love Fitzgerald and are intimately acquainted, this book is just filled. I mean, there are hundreds of Easter eggs in this book. And so my hope is that it is, you know, extra delightful for those people that really love his work, because there are so many call outs to not only all of his novels, but many of his short stories as well.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think it works. I don't know, when I teach, I say that allusions should only add. They should never leave anyone out, and I think you've, like, hit that.
Thank you.
But for those, it's very, like, if you know, you know, and it is like a chocolate chip cookie where the chips are, like, Fitzgerald quotes, and they're, like, tasty. And so I'm curious, from, like, a craft perspective, like, how did you, because you said, and I can tell, I'm so glad you said it, because I was like, I knew it, that you read everything, but how did you decide, like, which of the many, many passages to include? And then more interestingly, because it's not just, like, in there to be in there's sake, it's very tied to each of the characters, different people at different times, or, like, thinking or quoting or being, you know, echoed. And so how did you put the chips in the cookie?
Oh, yeah. It was a little back-ass words. Like, I think, you know, as I mentioned, I had written this really quickly, and I had done so, you know, one of the reasons, it's really funny that I wrote a thriller, because I'm scared of action movies. So one of the reasons why I did it was because I thought, when I looked at myself as a writer, I thought that my weakness was in plot and structure. And so I said, I got to fix this. How am I going to fix this? Well, thrillers live and die by plot. If you don't have a tight plot, it does not work. And so I took this as a challenge, and I went from being a pantser, where you're basically just sort of writing into the ether and hoping that it's going to come together, where I would inevitably write myself into a corner, to now I am a diehard plotter. And I hate writing outlines. They're miserable, but they are the scaffolding, the jungle gym on which I can play. So I had created a, you know, not bulletproof, but a tight outline before I even began. And so because Fitzgerald came in later, I had a pretty strong sense of the story and the characters and sort of all of, you know, the way in which the plot was braided together. And so since Fitzgerald was this huge second layer that came in once the plot was already there, reading all of his work with that in the back of my head, I was reading selfishly, totally. So I amassed a Bible, basically, of Fitzgerald that I thought, ooh, this could potentially be a tie into Sweet Fury. And I way overwrote and put way too much. And then it was just it became an art of just picking out and pulling out until I just sort of had the essence.
Was it hard to get permission to use all of those?
Well, almost all of them are in the public domain. Yeah, Tender as the Night was tricky, because it is not. And, you know, my book, well, so I had to be very careful, and that is one of the reasons why the book is in conversation with his entire work and not just with Tender as the Night. But, you know, I will say that it is in many ways a love letter to Fitzgerald. You know, as I mentioned, I first read Gatsby in high school, and I loved it when I read it in high school. One of my favorite things as a reader are authors that have incredibly lyrical, poetic language, and Fitzgerald is just the master of that. His prose is exquisite. And that is, I mean, I think Gatsby is the masterpiece, but, you know, it's there in all of his works. However, while it is in part a love letter to his works, it is also a critique of his work. It is not looking, you know, just revering Fitzgerald. So, you know, as I did all of this research about Fitzgerald and became more acquainted with the writer and Fitzgerald the man, I also came to understand his shortcomings. And what I'm talking about here, what I take issue with, are, you know, the racism, the sexism, the anti-Semitism, the homophobia, the classism, I mean, all of the isms. And of those, Sweet Fury addresses the misogyny in his writing. And to be fair, you know, he wrote this, he was writing 100 years ago. He's a product of his time. And yet, at the same time, does that mean that we should give him a pass? Should we continue to revere him as the great American writer, or should these failings in some way be addressed? And so Sweet Fury is my attempt to do that.
Yeah, and early on, I'm going to quote a little bit of your book to you, because I love to quote, because it's so fun to quote. Lila Crane, the, you know, Nicole Diver, the actress, says, "Our version of Tender isn't another tragedy of the tortured white man. It's a feminist story of healing, of reparation." And she adds that Nicole has overcome her trauma and reclaimed her life. And so I think one of the main questions that the book sort of seems to ask is, you know, I want to ask partly about that. You've kind of touched on this, you know, canonical people who we don't necessarily want to like de-pedestal, but we want to see in all of their facets. And then also this question of who is or isn't a victim, and to, I mean, their revenge comes in, but the concept of justice. So can you talk a little bit more about all of that stuff in the book?
Yeah. I mean, I think there are a lot of Me Too stories out there. A lot of them are revenge stories. I think in writing this book, one of the most important things for me was to avoid a story that felt black and white. I wanted everyone and everything in this book to live in the gray area, because that for me felt most true to my experience of life. So there is no character in this book that is strictly a hero or strictly a villain. They are all, to varying degrees, limited and flawed human beings. They all also have hidden identities. There's only, I think, one character in the book who is who they seem to be from beginning to end. The title of the third section of the book is a quote taken from Tender as the Night, "We must all try to be good." And I chose that for many reasons, but one of which is that each and every one of these characters is trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, and that kind of, I love too, because it seems like the book is very self-aware in talking about those things, but also in some people not wanting to talk about those things. Mm-hmm. And at one point you have Lila talking to this colleague, Nancy, another, you know, woman in the industry, and says, "Men prey on women over and over through the generations, continually coveting the younger, shinier model. And as a result, women are stripped of individuality when viewed through the male gaze." And that's what Lila sort of is saying kind of in this conversation about the project. And then Nancy says, "Oh, that's good. Very woke." And I guess I'm, you know, curious, like, did you think that? Did you have this whole like woke, anti-woke thing in your mind? Or were you like, "I'm just going to entertain"? Or like, how did you navigate that? I think you navigated it well, because first and foremost, this is just like a page turner, like a stay up late and like cancel your morning appointments kind of thing. But it's also a thinker. So how did you handle that?
Yeah, the woke line is just to really undercut myself. Like, I don't want to take it too seriously. But yeah, I mean, I think I wanted, with all of these characters, because nobody is a hero or a villain, a lot of these characters are dealing with serious trauma. That is a theme in this book. And so there are a lot of things happen in this book that are absolutely reprehensible. But my hope is for the reader's experience that as you go through and you become more and more horrified, that you can also still always understand why they did what they did, even if you disagree with it. That there is always, you can always maintain a degree of empathy with each of these characters, no matter who turns into a monster.
Yeah, and with that, one of the things I like about doing these things is I get an ARC, an advanced reader copy, so I get to read it before most people get to read it, and the ARCs come with things like the Dear Reader letter. And in your Dear Reader letter, you have this thing that I think is very relevant to what we're saying now, where you call Sweet Fury a book for the romantic at heart. And like, I read that at the beginning and I was like, huh, okay. And then as I was reading the book, I was like, what kind of romantic is this book for? And I loved it because I think, you know, like, one of the things the book does is like that there's characters who have romantic ideas of who they are and what they're doing or what they've done in their past or what they think they're doing with their present actions. And then, you know, like any good thriller, there's all these like crosses and double crosses and things aren't what they seem. But I'm curious, like, do you consider yourself a romantic, and how do you see this book as romantic?
That's such a good question. I've never been asked that before. Well, I definitely am a romantic. And Jonah, who is one of the main characters and who absolutely adores and reveres Fitzgerald is a total romantic. You know, I think, I don't know, this is a bit of a tangent, but, you know, what, something that it's sort of bringing up for me is thinking about the locations of these books and sort of why I chose to set them there, which is both the Hamptons and the West Village, which are, to me, these places that are very sort of Fitzgeraldian in that they, the Hamptons is a stone's throw from where Gatsby was set, of course, but they are also representative of his trademark subject matter, and he is such a romantic, right? And their romantic beauty, the ostentatious wealth, the hedonistic lifestyle, and in sort of a larger scope, Sweet Fury is commentary on America's persistent obsession with money. You know, to be successful in America is to be rich. This is as true today as it was 100 years ago when Gatsby was written. And so, you know, the romanticism for me comes a lot of it in sort of the depictions of these beautiful idealized locations, their idealized lives. And my intention there was to depict these, you know, the sort of perfect West Village, the perfect Hamptons in all of their beauty, and then peel back the skin to the gritty underbelly of this world where fame and wealth persist in being our cultural religion. So I'm trying to portray this, the romantic's view of life, and then show sort of the ugliness underneath. It's both.
Yeah, and I just to, like, so it's almost, I have like 2-3 more questions and then it's your time to shine, so get your questions fired up. But building on that, because like I definitely, Jonah the psychiatrist is this, I think, super fascinating character because he, without giving too much away, has these like very noble ideas of himself. And then as the book unfolds, you realize that perhaps he has been deluding himself. But there's a passage on page 176 where he thinks about beauty and how people often want to believe that beautiful people are good and truthful. And it says, all his life, he'd felt an insatiable romantic hunger for beauty, conflating it in that Kantian way as the symbol of the morally good. And so I just think that's inherently interesting. And so two parts, like what is it about beauty and how we just get like bamboozled by it? And two, I think the book is very, like we could hear in just the passage that we heard at the beginning, it's in this like lush, plush, Fitzgeraldian prose, and you're using this beautiful language to write about some like pretty twisted stuff by the end. So like, how did you, you know, decide to handle like beauty and ugliness in the book?
I just feel like it's such an American thing, right? I mean, it's for me, and this is another reason why this is set in the film industry where, I mean, we're obsessed with famous people and celebrity. It's ridiculous, but America is. And beauty and glamour and wealth and all of these sort of surface and really at the end of the day meaningless things. And so that paragraph you know, it, to me, is representative of sort of a inherited cultural mindset in America. It's also something that I deal with every day too. You know, I put myself in that situation. You know, I deliberately set the novel in this film industry where women in particular have this impossible balancing act to pull off. You know, Lila is incredibly beautiful and also incredibly clever, and she is burying past trauma and hiding current abuse, all while projecting this perfect image of America's sweetheart that the world expects of her.
All right, last official question. In the Dear Reader letter, you use this metaphor that I really like, because I'm always thinking about, like, what is reading? Like, we're all here at the American Writers Museum, and what is the magic of reading? And so you say, I think of my stories as a crystal prism. I spend years cutting the glass just so, fine-tuning the angles and edges as best I can. Left on its own, it's only a pretty piece of glass. The questions, the story in the story remain questions. You, dear reader, are the light. So I want to pause and just appreciate that. Isn't that cool? Like a cool way to describe reading. But I'm interested in what books, besides Fitzgerald, obviously, you as a reader helped you decide to write this. Like, were there thrillers, or were there, you know, other things about like the industry, or like how did you get your prism to like make, you know, to come into being?
Mm-hmm. Lauren Groff is a huge inspiration for me. This is something kind of crazy that I do, but every single year I reread Fates and Furies. It's one of my favorite books. I just think she's sort of the Fitzgerald's contemporary in terms of exquisite language. I think nobody does prose better than her, and I find something new every time. So she is a huge inspiration in terms of sort of the lyrical language that I strive to do. Donna Tartt is another. She's, you know, I hope someday I might sort of climb in that direction as a writer. But she's the master. And I'm just waiting for that fourth novel to come out. Yes, I mean, I could give you a whole laundry list of all my favorite authors. But.
Oh, that's great. Secret History Forever. If you haven't read the Donna Tartt Secret History, read it. Read it tonight. I can come up with more. I have more questions, but it's your turn. So I'm going to turn it over to you. And if you raise your hand, we have this microphone that we would request that you use.
So have you returned to directing? And what's in your future? Are you a writer or a director or both?
I have not returned to directing. This has been amazingly a full-time job, which is such a gift, and I am finding it to be really satisfying because while I love theater and love directing and I think I was good at it, I am totally an introvert at heart, and I really love just being in my own little bubble and creating the worlds of these books. I've written the first draft of my next novel, which is under contract, so that's on its way. It's a mess, guys, but it's but it's on its way. It's much more ambitious. I'm really excited about it. But you know, I mean, the pipe dream, if you're asking, is this is making the rounds in LA, you know, for an adaptation. And somewhere, not for this, but just somewhere down the line in my career, it would be amazing if I could get to a place where I could adapt and direct the projects myself.
So, Sash.
Yes.
I feel like I could ask you this question because I'm your uncle, and hopefully it's not too personal. But you live in New York, in the West Village, in a fairly small place. With four
That's
cats.
Putting it mildly.
Oh, yeah, how many square feet?
650 square feet.
650 square feet with four cats, a couple are semi-feral.
One feral.
One feral. Mm-hmm. Two dogs.
Mm-hmm. Big dogs.
A brand new husband over here, Ben. Two boys on weekends.
Yeah.
How do you find it possible to write one coherent word and find the space to do that?
It's a really good question.
I would go crazy. I couldn't do it.
Yeah. Well, I wrote this during the pandemic. We were in a different apartment. We were in a much bigger apartment. So it remains to be seen. But I will say that what makes me really happy, sort of my happy morning as a writer, is I have the animals all gather kumbaya style around me. So I have the two dogs on the floor. One is usually like belly up. And then I have a cat in my lap, a cat on my keyboard stepping on the keys. I have a cat draped across my shoulders, so I'm like this. And then the feral cat's in the closet. So and that just makes me so happy. I mean, my husband is in the other, we only have two rooms. My husband's in the other room, like booming on Zoom, doing all of his calls throughout the day. And so I've usually got like noise canceling headphones, but as long as I have the animals, I'm happy.
Did you work with an editor? And if so, what is that process like? You have your baby that you've written, and somebody comes in and gives you notes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it was great. I love my editor. She is one of the sort of top of the rung at Simon & Schuster, the flagship imprint. Her name's Karina Guiderman. But basically, because it was a debut, and I don't know if this was your experience too, but it's just so hard to get a book sold when nobody knows who you are that you have to get the book super polished before it's ready to go out to editors. And so, you know, I had done all of the editing with my amazing writers group who, I mean, I'm serious when I'm saying this book wouldn't exist without my writers group. They really helped form this book. And then I had to find agents, and I basically shot for the stars and just emailed blind my, like, the fanciest agents that I could find, one of whom responded and said, you know, give me the weekend, I'm halfway through. And then by Monday, she had offered to work with me. It was amazing. And I spent, a year and a half editing with them. So she's a tastemaker in the industry, and she said, this is a great book, it's going to be a big book, it's going to be the next Gone Girl, but it needs a lot of work. And so it was a year and a half of editing, and I mean, especially the ending, oh my God, it was like 4 months of just reworking and reworking and reworking the ending. And I actually got to a place where I was like, I can't see straight. I don't think I can edit it any further. And she was like, okay, well, then we're not going to be able to send it to, like, big editors because they're not going to take it because it needs more work. And I was like, oh, shit. You know, I'm like, I'll edit more. You know, and so it was so edited by the time that it went out to publishing houses that I did have another, you know, year of editing with my editor, but there were no huge changes at that point. It was just fine-tuning, refining, and it certainly made the book a lot better, but the major, you know, the meat of the work happened with my agents.
I love your presentation and the professor's snappy questions. It's been great. I had a question about your process.
Yeah.
When you're in the middle of writing or even just starting to write something, do you have a schedule during the day where I'm up at 6, the cats and I are writing by 6:30, and I stop at noon every day and try to stick to that? Or what is your process?
I have to work out before I'm like obsessed with working out. So that's what I do first thing to wake myself up. But then, yeah, I have to start writing in the morning. I find that if I wait until the afternoon, I'm just screwed for the rest of the day and the writing is total crap. My process, as I said, I rely on an outline. So my next book it's a 40-page outline. And this is not like bullet points. This is like paragraphs. So 40 pages. And so this is my Bible. And then I do the word count thing. So I write 2,000 words a day and then I stop. And the words I'm telling you are horrible. They are almost always horrible, but I allow myself that grace because for me, the scariest thing is the blank page. And just once I have those crappy words on the page, I know I can go back and edit it.
Will you sign books for people if they get copies?
Yes.
All right. And
can we thank Kathleen Rooney and Sash Biskov?
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.